This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
We unfortunately see a lack of political will and time for the parties to stop fighting and, in fact, are accelerating.
That's U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, who says some aid is getting into Sudan, but the conflict continues. Details coming up. Also, a Chinese naval task force recently visited Africa as part of an effort to enhance relations. And Namibia blocked a ship because it allegedly was carrying weapons for Israel. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The chief negotiator at U.S.-mediated peace talks on Sudan says breakthroughs for greater humanitarian access that were achieved in the first round of negotiations last week are holding and are expanding. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United States Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, credits the breakthroughs on the Sudan talks to the commitment of delegates from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, among other participants, to alleviate the suffering of tens of millions of Sudanese. He says opening the Adre border became possible when negotiators got guarantees of access from the Sudan Armed Forces and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces to allow aid to flow from Chad to Darfur. Similarly, he says negotiators in Geneva last week got pledges from the warring parties of guarantees of access across the Daba Road coming east from Port Sudan.
Both of those remain active and open now, with dozens of trucks crossing and nearly 6 million pounds of food and emergency relief reaching areas in need. We need that to continue and to accelerate, and we are actively negotiating on a daily basis for additional expansions, including access through Sennar State into the heartland of Sudan.
Perriello spoke to journalists Thursday in an online news conference. He highlighted the importance of keeping these humanitarian corridors open, noting that many of the 25.6 million Sudanese suffering from acute hunger have received little or no assistance for months. He says a breakthrough also was reached on the issue of protection. He says negotiators were able to get a commitment on a code of conduct by the RSF, adding that the code has to be disseminated to all fighting forces by the end of the month. However, he says the Geneva talks failed to reach an agreement on halting hostilities.
We unfortunately see a lack of political will at the time for the parties to stop fighting, and in fact are accelerating. And on that, and second, we have to find a way to get the parties together to find an end to this war that is leading to the suffering of millions inside Sudan, as well as spilling over increasingly into the neighboring countries.
While the RSF sent a delegation, the Sudan Armed Forces stayed away, citing concern at the Emirates' presence at the talks. The Armed Forces alleged the Emirates sent arms to the RSF, a claim the UAE denies. Perriello acknowledges the difficulty of reaching a peace agreement with the presence of only one of the warring parties. Despite this handicap, Perriello says agreements on humanitarian issues have been reached because he has been in contact with SAF representatives by phone on a daily basis. He adds nonstop negotiations to improve the desperate plight of the Sudanese people are continuing virtually with all participants. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Parts of the 46th Chinese Naval Escort Task Force visited Egypt, Morocco, the Gulf of Aden, and the waters of Somalia over several months this year as part of a recent effort by Beijing to enhance relations with African countries. Dave DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, discussed such Chinese efforts with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It's a long-standing Chinese desire to expand its naval presence into the Atlantic Ocean and into the Mediterranean. Part of that is motivated by a desire to increase its influence in Africa. Part of it is motivated by a desire to provide an additional area that NATO member nations, not acting as NATO, like the United States, like France, like Germany, like Britain, have to take into account. And part of it comes from their shock, really, when Libya imploded and they had a large number of Chinese citizens who needed to be evacuated. So all of this led them to believe that they need to develop a naval capability that can operate off of Africa.
The Algerian military has taken delivery of the Chinese-made YJ-12B anti-ship cruise missiles, which is considered the most lethal anti-ship missiles China has manufactured thus far, according to the Pentagon report. Moreover, Algeria is reported to be in talks with China to acquire SY-400 Chinese-made short-range ballistic missiles. What do you make of China's extending its military involvement in North Africa?
Well, China has long been a military supplier for sub-Saharan African countries and to a more limited extent to North Africa. They generally provide weapons that are cheap, of dubious quality, but their quality has been increasing of late. And it's also, you know, not unknown for China to provide ballistic missiles, which some countries are reluctant to provide, particularly Western countries. What is unusual is that in the past, providers of advanced technology to Algeria has been Russia. And Algeria, there are many years where Algeria and India are the two top destinations for Russian weapons exports. But I think because of the war in Ukraine and doubts about Russia's capability to maintain its defense export base, the diversion of Russian weapons that had been scheduled for export to Russian internal use in the invasion of Ukraine, and the increase in Chinese domestic capability and Chinese weapons qualities, it's sort of a natural evolution that you would see China supplant Russia as the weapons provider of choice for Algeria.
The Ivorian military has acquired additional armored vehicles from China to enhance its combat lethality. China has become a key partner of Ivory Coast, providing military training, equipment, and technology. The army said the new armored vehicles will help the military effectively monitor its northern border, which have seen jihadist attacks in recent years. Is China using its arms sale to show it can help African countries in counter-terrorism efforts?
China has been using arms sales to African countries, more specifically sub-Saharan African countries like Cote d'Ivoire, for decades. So China, a very strong weapons exporter, and that's been the case for decades. So I think this is, again, not really a new development. It might be new for Cote d'Ivoire.
But is that a new role for China after the United States and France left Africa?
Well, the United States and France haven't totally left Africa. There's still a large French presence in Chad, and basically they've left Mali and they've left Niger. There clearly is a concern about countries on the southern edge of the Sahel that the instability from Niger, from Mali, and of course we've seen the Malian forces and their supporting Wagner group follow-on, that which Russia calls the Africa Corps. We've seen them defeated by Tuareg militia, pretty spectacular defeat. So these countries are concerned that this instability in the now Russia-aligned Sahel states will bleed over.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The World Health Organization is holding its Africa regional meeting this week in Brazzaville, Republic of Congo. Reporter Eric Kawa is there, and he caught up with Sierra Leone's Minister of Health, Austin Dembe. Here's an excerpt.
Well, malaria is the number one killer in Sierra Leone, and I think for us, we're doing everything in our power to turn this around. We have a multi-step strategy. First, we've introduced a new malaria vaccine, we have over 1.5 million doses of the vaccine that we're administering. At the same time, for a population of about 8 million people, we have about 5 million insecticide-treated nets that we're distributing throughout the country. We're also looking at diagnostic capability with rapid tests and smear microscopy. We're looking at insecticide indoor residual spraying that will reduce the number of vectors that are available. And I think a combination of these, we think, will make a major change in the health outcomes around malaria. Will reduce the infection rate and will reduce the mortality associated with it. So all of these things have been in play with this rainy season. And I think as we're coming to the end of the rainy season, we'll have a quick evaluation to see what the delta was, what the change was before and after our interventions.
Let me divert your attention a bit to another health-related issue that has to do with the mpox, which is now prevalent. There were some suspected cases in Sierra Leone, but there were certain clinical trials and that was seemed to be negative. But then how prepared is Sierra Leone's Minister of Health, or what are the strategies that have been put in place to probably be in better alert?
Well, I think Sierra Leone is perhaps in the most prepared state than we've ever been. I think coming back from an Ebola experience, you saw how we dealt with COVID. I mean, there's a lot of internal experience around managing epidemics. And I think for us, we're very, very grateful that we have an institutional home that harnesses prevention, preparedness and response. We have a new National Public Health Agency. The new National Public Health Agency, it's dedicated to preventing these kinds of outbreaks, but at the same time, preparing for them, and at the same time, being able to respond very, very quickly to these outbreaks. So what we've also had is what we call field epidemiologists. We have over 450 trained field epidemiologists who are embedded in our primary healthcare system. They look to see the support, the primary healthcare system, and support local PHUs and DHMTs, the district health medical teams, to look at their data on a regular basis. And when they see anything unusual, they alert National Public Health Agency, and a rapid response team is deployed to be able to help the local teams manage the situation. So that's what you see, you know, with MPOX. The country is ready, and what we've done is alerted all of the district health medical teams, and everybody's on the lookout. We've had clinical signs and symptoms of what to expect, and we have instructions on how to manage this. So what you see now is very active surveillance that's going on, not only in the border areas, but throughout the country. And if you see anybody with fever, pain, and rash, what you do is you alert the health system, and a team will go out there and rush in there and see if it's MPOX, we'll contain the person, we'll treat the patient, we'll manage the patient, we'll break potential for transmission.
That was Austin Demby, Sierra Leone's health minister. He was speaking with reporter Eric Kawa at the WHO Africa Regional Meeting in Brazzaville. You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Hundreds of thousands protested across Nigeria earlier this month over inflation and other economic hardships, which have cost the economy millions of dollars. Similar protests of young activists dubbed Gen Z have also occurred in Kenya, Uganda, and other countries. To learn more about the commonalities among the protesters, VOA's Paul Ndiho spoke with Dr. Yotende Odugbesanya-Omidi, a global affairs and political professor at the State University of New York, Farmingdale State College.
When you have a situation where the youth continue to outpace and outnumber other age demographics, and there are not enough opportunities for them to excel and succeed, there are not enough labor force or job infrastructure that are created where they can go into the labor market and assume jobs. And so what happens when you have a restless youth population who do not have any means or any way out, and how do they fend for themselves and their families, you create an atmosphere and create an environment that leads exactly to this type of unrest. Politicians need to take a look and see this, right? They need to take a look because what happens is that we live in the technological age. This is a youth that were born during the digital age. They are the controllers of the digital economy, right? They are the controllers of digitization. And for them not to be able to give opportunities to, I would say, be able to express their skill sets in the best way, right? What is a degree if it cannot be put to use, right? And it's not only the responsibility of the individual, it's also the responsibility of the government to ensure that there is a flourishing labor market and labor workforce and opportunities. And so as much as we want to say, please invest or bring investment to the continent and bring investment to Nigeria, that investment also has to turn into opportunities of employment for the young people who put themselves to school so that they can have a livelihood and make something of themselves. These riots are examples of this. There's the very reason.
For example, the intellectual balance of power has been shifting in the African youth's favor. They are more educated. They have access to Ivy League schools, even here in the United States, because of this information age. So they know what's happening all over the world. They see how governments are running their governments, or they see how these politicians are running their governments, and they're like, no, we've had enough. How would you respond to critics who say that maybe the governments are not paying attention to some of their needs?
It has to be true, right? So if they are in the streets protesting, if they're doing every single means to get the attention of the government or to get the attention of the elected leaders or to get the attention of the president, that means they're desperately seeking some type of way forward or desperately seeking some form of leadership. There's nothing wrong in communication, right? There's nothing wrong in talking to a population of people who feel desperate, who don't know where to go, who go to social media to vent their pain and frustration, who are trying to find ends meet on how do I pay my children's school fees? How do I keep a roof over my head? How do I buy the necessary things to just eat, rice, tomatoes, all of those things? And for a long, long time, people have been saying that, look, if the government doesn't do something, or if the government doesn't act fast, or the government is not strategic in the way that they communicate, what you'll end up seeing is that these young people who have been sort of sitting at the sideline, who's been grumbling and who's been grunting and who's been sharing their frustrations amongst one another, will now come into the forefront to now lead campaigns and now lead social movements that will garner international attention. And I think that's what's happening now. When there's nowhere to run, people end up running to the street.
That was Dr. Yutindi Odogbesin-Omidi, Professor of Global Affairs and Politics at the State University of New York Farmingdale State College, speaking to VOA's Paul Indiho. In this close U.S. presidential race, the southern state of Georgia is one of a handful of states that may decide the outcome. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on what the campaigns are doing in Georgia and how they hope to carry this key swing state.
Kamala Harris chose a bus trip through Georgia as her first post-Democratic convention campaigning, starting at a high school band practice where running mate Tim Walz talked about the joyful work of their campaign.
I'm grateful to be part of a team with a really great head coach here in your next president of the United States, Kamala Harris.
And Harris praised young Georgians' leadership.
Your generation, all that you guys stand for, everything you have at stake, is what is going to propel our country into the next era of what we can do, what we can do.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump led Georgia political polls through much of this election cycle. But with Joe Biden out of the race, most now show Trump and Harris are tied. Trump running mate J.D. Vance was in Georgia last week.
We're going to do it together, but only if you get us across the finish line in Georgia. This is one of the most important states in the union.
Vance and Trump are campaigning largely on what they say are economic and immigration policy failures, both of which Trump told Georgia voters should be blamed on Harris.
With your vote, inflation will stop. The illegal aliens will be turned back. They're not coming in. We got to stop them. Did you see where she's now saying, oh, we had a very good border. Oh, great. They had the worst border in the history of the world.
Trump winning Republican votes in Georgia is complicated by his denunciation of the state's popular Republican governor, Brian Kemp, who won re-election 2 years ago despite a Trump-backed primary challenge. Earlier this month, Trump repeatedly blamed Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger for his Georgia loss in 2020.
Raffensperger and Brian Kemp, your governor, who I got elected, by the way. If it wasn't for me, he would not be your governor. I think everybody knows that. He's a very disloyal person, isn't he? Very disloyal.
With Georgia polls tightening, Trump used his social media site last week to thank Kemp for all his help and support in Georgia. Kemp is set to co-host a Trump fundraiser in Atlanta Thursday. A Georgia grand jury indicted Trump and some of his allies last year over their attempts to illegally interfere with the state's 2020 election results. Trump attorneys this week again appealed for the dismissal of those charges in a case that will not go to trial before Election Day. Georgia's state election board Monday approved new rules that critics say could disrupt finalizing the state's November election results. Two board members voted against the change. The three board members who passed it were all hailed by name by Trump this month as, quote, pit bulls fighting for honesty, transparency, and victory. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Ruth Chirwa is transforming the fashion industry in Malawi and other developing countries, winning awards and gaining international recognition for her designs. Chirwa's fashion line, Upi Collection, is hosting a fashion show next month that aims to break down barriers between people with disabilities and those without. Lamek Masina reports from Mzuzu City in northern Malawi.
Ruth Chirwa's entry into the fashion industry was not planned.
I never thought about fashion designing. I never thought that I'd be a fashion designer. Growing up, all I thought was I would do business management.
But that changed when a lecturer suggested she switched to fashion design because of the stylish outfits she wore to class. Now, 3 years into her career, Chirwa has received praise for her designs and started a fashion brand, Upi Collection, based in Nzuzu, Malawi.
I remember in 2022, I managed to win an award for Focus on Ability Short Films, first of all. I won as Best Actress on my documentary that I submitted.
She was also named Best Female Star Fashion Designer at the 2023 Shining Stars Africa Awards. And recently, Chirwa's designs were shown in Portugal thanks to the help of fellow Malawian designers Riri Afonso and Zandria. It has not always been easy for Chirwa, who recalls times when some people refused to buy clothes from her because she has a disability. But she says she has managed to curb discrimination by believing in herself and meeting her clients' expectations.
When it comes to my creations, I always want to deliver. And also, it's a matter of me doing what I know best.
Celebrities and prominent fashion designers in Malawi, like Chris Ngalu, appreciate the uniqueness of her designs.
A lot of fashion designers in Malawi, they like to just stand behind making clothes with, like, for example, Chitenge and stuff. But her stuff is, like, out of the box. It's very modern and it's a breath of fresh air.
Chirwa has also become a source of pride for her former learning institution. Joyce Sichari is the executive of Nzuzu Disability Organization.
Ruth has inspired many learners with disabilities here. Most people with disabilities tend to be down on themselves, but Ruth has proven that anyone can do anything.
Chirwa is preparing to host a fashion show early next month that aims to challenge societal norms and promote diversity and inclusion, especially of people with disabilities. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Nzuzu, Malawi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheye Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.